Are we seeing the dawning of the Pacific century? And what can its past teach us about its future?
In the last 30 years, most of the powers that have colonized the Pacific and its neighbors have moved away. So the Pacific is getting able to stand on her own two feet, and Polynesia in particular. That is becoming a place now that is teaching us wonderful things about its old traditions. These Polynesian people were wonderful, and they had great knowledge, and we shouldn't disdain and disrespect them as we have for the last 200 years. We should respect them and the ocean they live in.
That's Simon Winchester talking about his book, Pacific. Then, in the second half of today's show, we talk about a family divided on both sides of the Pacific Ocean. We talk with Pamela Rottner Sakamoto about her story of a Japanese-American family caught between two worlds during World War II. It's called Midnight in Broad Daylight. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us on this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. In 2011, Simon Winchester came out with a book about the Atlantic Ocean, called, appropriately, Atlantic. It was very much a look back at the history of an ocean that has in many ways defined the rise of civilization. Last year, Winchester came out with a companion for ocean-loving readers, the book Pacific. This book looks forward to a shift in the geopolitical axis of the globe toward the lands that rim its greatest ocean. Winchester examines 10 signal events. They include the atom bomb tests in the Pacific, how climate change is threatening ocean species, North Korea's development of nuclear weapons, and how new technology is opening up the ocean floor to exploitation. Pacific was a finalist for the Kirkus Prize for Nonfiction. Simon Winchester is the best-selling author of 12 books of nonfiction, including Krakatoa, The Professor and the Madman, and A Crack in the Edge of the World, which we spoke to him about in 2007. Simon Winchester, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Well, thanks a lot.
And here we are talking about your latest book, Pacific. The Atlantic Ocean seems to get all the fame and glory. You actually wrote a book about the Atlantic Ocean as well. Why the Pacific this time?
I think the thesis, and this relates to the Atlantic as well, is quite simple, and it's the sort of overarching theory I have about world politics at the moment, which is that the Mediterranean can rightly be considered the inland sea of the classical world, and the Atlantic Ocean, the inland sea of the modern world, and I think that's why it gets so much coverage and it's so well known. And the Pacific, if you agree with the earlier arguments, is the inland sea of tomorrow's world. And so it's something of a mystery, because to work out what's happening there and what's likely to happen in the future, the divining of the likely evolution of this gigantic body of water is necessarily rather difficult. So this was a difficult book to write. I mean, it was enormous fun, but the Atlantic was relatively easy. The Pacific, because a lot of it is speculative, is much more tricky.
Speculative in what sense?
Well, because we don't really know what is going to happen. I mean, let's specifically talk about geopolitics, for instance. We have now facing each other across the Pacific two countries, two societies, two civilizations, if you like, which are to be regarded in many ways as the antithesis of each other, but both equally big and equally powerful. And I mean by that the United States and China. If you rewind that a little, well, a lot, actually, and remember the origins of humankind beginning in East Africa, and they move north and split into two at that point, with one group going east to Mesopotamia, the Indus Valley, to China, and the other group going west through the Balkans and into Europe. Well, the Europeans then crossed the Atlantic, and those who settled in the New World of the Americas moved relentlessly westward under forces like the Manifest Destiny, arrived on the shores of the Pacific, and then eventually, in the 16th century, crossed the Pacific. And by doing so, the two great civilizations at long last confronted one another. And when you ask what is speculative, it's how in the future those two societies now looking at each other and intimately involved with each other deal with each other. Will it be confrontational or will it be cooperative? And that is one of the major questions of modern history, really. It's a hinge point in history, how these two civilizations will deal with each other, and they will be dealing with each other on and across the Pacific Ocean, which is why I think it's so important.
And you find the roots in that cross-Pacific relationship between the United States, which, of course, has a Pacific coast, and the world of Asia, of East Asia. You choose 10 signal events, starting with the use of the South Pacific Islands of Polynesia as a place where the hydrogen bomb was tested by first the United States and then France. You pick the date of January 1st, 1950, when Truman decided to test the hydrogen bomb, and you say that was the beginning of the present. Why was it the beginning of the present?
Well, BP, before present, is the dating system now universally used among scientists dealing with ancient events. We talk about the Wisconsin Ice Age, for instance, as having occurred 10,000 years BP before present. But when is present? It sounds a rather fatuous question. But the index year has been chosen by scientists to be 1950, and the date of the beginning, the 1st of January 1950, is the beginning of present. And the reason that it's so defined is all to do with carbon dating techniques, because before 1950, it was easy to do carbon dating because the ratio between carbon-12 and carbon-14 was known. But after 1950, because of nuclear testing, one of the byproducts of nuclear explosions is carbon-14. An enormous amount of it was pumped into the atmosphere by those countries doing atomic testing. And so the ratio was distorted. And so for many, many years, carbon-14 dating became almost impossible to accomplish. And you had to each year introduce an algorithm to correct it. So the radiochemists, basically a group in Belfast in Northern Ireland, came up with the idea that before 1950, the world was pure. And after 1950, the world was tainted, was impure. And I seized on that date because the impurities were nearly all of them thrown up into the atmosphere from tests that were conducted in the Pacific Ocean. So it seemed both scientifically logical and relevant to the Pacific, and that's why I decided to begin the book then.
And it's not just a scientific story. You go fairly deeply into what happened to the people who were living there, the Pacific Islanders, specifically of the Bikini Atoll, but also others who were the human victims of this contamination. Talk about what happened with them.
Well, I mean, there were many cases, and the Bikinians are one of the groups of victims. They were asked, requested, or essentially forced to leave their island in the late 1940s, and the island was blown to smithereens and contaminated. And they sat miserably on a group of islands in the southern Marshall Islands, and oddly enough and ironically enough, because of rising sea levels, their homes are now being flooded, you know, a double whammy for these poor people, and they're requesting asylum in Britain and the United States to come and look after them. But that's one story, but there are even more wretched stories than theirs, and I think the people that have been largely forgotten now are the inhabitants of two other islands close to Bikini called Rongelap and Rongerik, which were contaminated by a gigantic explosion which went off in 1954 called Castle Bravo, the biggest bomb ever exploded by the United States, 50 megatons of TNT equivalent, sent up a tower 20 miles high with a cauliflower top 60 miles across. I mean, it was a gigantic explosion. And these people, innocent Pacific Islanders who were just mending their nets and going out in their little boats and fishing and collecting coconuts and doing the things that Pacific Islanders characteristically do, were suddenly rained upon by showers of what looked to them like snow, which they picked up and licked and tasted, and It was all calcined coral from the explosion in Bikini, and they were all incredibly sick and vomiting and staggering about, and the Americans didn't move them initially. They thought, well, this is very interesting. Let's study them as sort of almost like laboratory animals. Eventually they were moved, but they've suffered terribly as a result, and genetically, and aborted fetuses and sort of tragedies like that. And we paid them very little heed, very little compensation. They just, they were human beings on which we could experiment in a almost, as I say, like laboratory animals. So we've done that kind of thing all too often, and the British did it in Christmas Island, the French in French Polynesia in the South Pacific, because the American experiments were in the Northwest Pacific. So the legacy of thermonuclear testing has been one of relentless tragedy.
There's also poverty that has really attended them. I mean, it's not just the nuclear testing, but also they're some of the most exploited modern colonial people, you could almost say, in some of those islands in the Pacific. Is that right?
Well, it's absolutely right. I mean, because sticking for the moment with the Marshall Islands, there's an island there called Kwajalein, which is the site of a huge American missile testing base, the Ronald Reagan Pacific Missile Testing Station, where the islanders, there are 15,000 of them, are not allowed on the sort of country club-like islands of the atoll where the American base are and where the American military are. They're all corralled onto one miserable little island called Ibai, which is about as big as a New York City block, where now 15,000 people live in conditions of unredeemed squalor, with very poor sewage system, very little by way of schooling and stores, and it's utterly miserable. And yet these are their islands. That's the extraordinary thing. They're having forced to live in a slum in the middle of the tropics, and yet it is their island. Well, the American government will say, well, we pay them $17 million a year in rent for using the islands for missile testing. But where does that $17 million go? Well, the short answer is that the chiefs, the Marshallese chiefs, live in palatial mansions in Honolulu. So there's a great deal of corruption to be stirred into the story. So the whole thing, whether it's radiation or poverty or corruption, it's a mess. And it wouldn't have been a mess if the U.S. government had left them alone and just to be fishing and gathering coconuts and being Pacific peoples.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with author Simon Winchester about his latest book, Pacific. We won't go over all the 10 signal events, but touch on some of the ones that were most striking to me. A history that I really knew nothing about, just about 10 years after the bombing of Hiroshima, the first Japanese transistor radio was released. Is that right? August 7th, 1955? Tell us the story.
55, yep. It was released, first of all, in Canada, in Edmonton, Winnipeg, and Vancouver, and then became popular there, but became popular in New York shortly thereafter when a large shipment of these, they were called the TR-55, they fitted into your shirt pocket, and they changed radios for all time, because up to that moment, the radio set was a piece of furniture. It was covered with walnut veneer, it sat in the corner of the living room, you put the aspidistra on top of it, you turned it on, it warmed up, and you had to tune it in. But all of a sudden, you've got this little radio, which you could take out into the garden, or take to school, or put it by the swimming pool, or put it on the beach, and listen to your radio programs, or podcasts, I suppose, of the 1950s, such as they were. And it transformed. Personal electronics was the new watchword, and this little radio was made by a company whose name was in tiny letters on the dial. It was the name Sony. It was the first ever Sony electronic device, and it was followed swiftly by the Walkman and the Trinitron and the Betamax, all invented by one extraordinary man back in Japan called Masaru Ibuka. And the radio itself became popular, wildly popular, very quickly because of a burglary that happened in Queens in late, I think, 1955 or early 56, when 4,000 of these little radios were shipped to New York, the warehouse that they were stored in was burglarized, but the burglars only took this radio. There was lots of other electronic equipment which they ignored. And so the matter was reported in the New York Times. And New Yorkers said, well, what was good enough for the burglars is obviously good enough for us. And they placed orders, and the demand for these little things skyrocketed, and Sony was effectively born. And what was also born was this massive new trade in containers, shipping containers, which were invented at almost the same time in 1955. This west to east string of container ships going from ports like Yokohama to places like Long Beach and San Francisco. And then, you know, other companies, Panasonic and so forth, started making similar devices and Nikon cameras and so forth. And then the trade expanded to ports from Korea and nowadays from China. So whenever you see a big container ship coming under the Golden Gate Bridge, it's nice to remind yourself that this all really began in 1955 with one tiny radio being offered for sale in an electronics shop in Edmonton, Alberta. This device made by this long-forgotten man called Masaru Ibuka, who almost single-handedly altered trade in the Pacific for all time.
Well, I mean, the other thing that really impressed me is that this was just a mere 10 years after Japan's crushing defeat. Two atomic bombs, many cities utterly destroyed by firestorms from massive bombing. How did this, you know, resilience, this technological resilience, what do you ascribe it to?
Well, that's a very good question, because it can't be a racial thing, because much the same thing was, of course, happening in Germany, which revived itself with astonishing speed and determination. I just guess when it's the idea of the tabula rasa, when everything is cleared off the table, as it clearly was in Tokyo, which had been firebombed to near extinction, the people come out of the wreckage, clear themselves off, dust themselves down, and say, well, we're still here by the grace of something, and we're going to begin again from scratch. So I think an awful lot of the older ways of Japan, which were beginning, of course, to evaporate after the restoration of the emperor in 1857 and the arrival of the Admiral Perry's black ships, technology was sort of in the wind, as it were. And now you had a clean slate to work on, much as I say, Germany had as well. So both countries enjoyed an astonishing revival, which in a way impresses and daunts and terrifies us all to this day.
Now, there's a lot of information in your book, Simon Winchester, in Pacific, about the role of the Pacific Ocean as the generator of the world's weather. Well, there's a lot about weather and climate, which I think is, of course, probably the most critical issue that we as human beings have ever faced and are facing today. Talk about the Pacific Ocean and just, you know, let's just start with the science, you know, pre-anthropogenic climate change. What is the role of the Pacific Ocean in creating the weather?
The basic thing is the Pacific is so gigantic that it is the principal absorber in the planet of the heat that's radiated down from the sun. The water absorbs heat in a way that rocks don't. I mean, if you shelter under a rock, it warms up in the sunshine, but the moment the sun goes down, the rock becomes cold. Whereas it's not true with water. Water is warmed up, and it stays warm for a much longer time. Well, this is what happens in the Pacific and in spades, because it is so big, 64 million square miles of it. And this causes changes in the atmosphere above and circulations in the atmosphere above, which have a huge knock-on effect elsewhere. The key to it all is something known as the Walker circulation, which is a circulation of wind patterns in the Pacific, which was named for a remarkable and very eccentric English meteorologist called Gilbert Walker, who was in charge of the India Meteorological Office and was a big expert on the monsoon, one of the things in India that is affected by the weather in the Pacific. He was a remarkable man in and of himself, and his big expertise was in the pattern, how a bird flies. In other words, he was interested in the wings of a bird, and oddly enough, in the mechanics of the boomerang, and he became known as Boomerang Walker. So Boomerang Walker gave us the Walker circulation, which is one of the things that causes El Nino, which is this sudden and occasional, but ever more frequent phenomenon, which has all to do with the movement of a cold current in the eastern Pacific. It normally hugs the shore and causes fogs and so forth in places like Lima, but enables huge numbers of anchoveta, little anchovies, to form the basis of the Latin American, the Andean fishing industry. Every so often that moves further out to sea, the anchovies disappear, and this phenomenon known as the El Nino begins, which causes knock-on effects all around the world, and they're at the moment hoping that an El Nino is about to begin, because if it does, the long drought which has plagued California for the last many years possibly will come to an end. And there's been rain recently in both Los Angeles and San Francisco, and people are thinking, well, maybe the El Nino is the reason. But this goes on affecting rainfall patterns in the Great Plains, hurricanes in the Atlantic Ocean, snowfall in Europe. It's a long and technical argument which is only now being fully understood by the application of massive supercomputers, of which one of the biggest is known as the Earth Simulator 2, which is in a laboratory in just west of Tokyo. They're all crunching the numbers and steadily confirming their belief that as behaves the Pacific, so in weather terms behaves the rest of the world.
We're talking with author Simon Winchester about his latest book, Pacific. Well, Californians may be looking forward to a strong El Nino. I know that they are. I was there this summer, as a matter of fact, just before the fires totally overtook the state. But other parts of the world would be experiencing drought, terrible drought. So El Nino is not necessarily a benign phenomenon.
It's not benign at all, and there's this sort of ruthless and pitiless seesaw-like oscillation where rainfall in one part of the world, as you rightly say, can be echoed by drought in another part of the world. So if a drought afflicts, let's say, the jungles of Indonesia, and there are huge fires there destroying massive parts of Java, say, the Javanese will be upset. But on the other hand, the Californians will be happy. So I suppose what one might say as a climatologically is you can't please them all. And the world's weather is not going to be benign anywhere for long. But that doesn't detract from the main argument, which is that the Pacific is where it all begins.
Yes, and you also say that because of anthropogenic global warming, because of our, fossil fuel, our carbon dioxide emissions, that ocean warming could lead to a permanent El Nino. How does that work?
Yes, but there are other considerations, too, which I find absolutely fascinating. One of them I actually discovered when I was doing the book on the Atlantic, but it applies also in the Pacific, and that's this remarkable little creature which was discovered as recently as 1989 in the sea, a single-celled sort of algae called Prochlorococcus, which turns out to be, even though we didn't know it existed until 1989, the most numerous creature on the planet. There are more of Prochlorococcus than anything else. And the remarkable thing about it is that it absorbs carbon dioxide and emits oxygen to the extent that one in five of the breaths that we take today is generated by this little creature that we didn't even know existed 20 years ago. But the thing about Prochlorococcus is that it loves warm water. The warmer the waters get, and we know they are warming, the more of them there'll be and the greater their range. At the moment, they extend from about 40 degrees north to about 30 degrees south. As the water warms up, the range will extend and more carbon dioxide will be absorbed by them and more oxygen will be generated. Now, this may not do us any good at all. We may all die largely as a result of the disasters that we have created anthropogenically with all the man-made carbon dioxide and so forth. But the world will recover. The world will eventually shrug it off. The world has this ability to repair itself. The so-called James Lovelock was the man that came up with the term the Gaia theory, about the world has this immense capacity for repairing herself. It seems that Prochlorococcus is going to be the key, and the seas, damaged though they may be, rising though they may be, doing increasing acidity, all of these bad things are happening, killing the corals, flooding islands, and heating up. And yet, in the long run, everything will be okay. We'll do damage, but it'll only be, in a global perspective, little damage, and we'll be the principal victims.
Well, that seems like it could be poetic justice, but I've also heard that, you know, there are feedback loops, and this is actually a lucky negative feedback loop, but there are also positive feedback loops, you know, such as increased emissions of carbon dioxide because of the tundra melting. Do you think on balance that the Earth will still be able to repair itself and avoid runaway climate change?
I'm convinced it will. And that belief is shared by much wiser people than I. Of course, it's good for the press, and it's fascinating to talk about runaway climate and uncontrollable climate change, and that will kill everything. Well, it won't. It'll kill us. I mean, my old geology professor at Oxford, he believes, well, he's now himself passed away, but before he died, he believed that humankind would probably not exist for more than another 500 years. Mm. And I think that's probably a generous estimate. I mean, a couple of centuries, if given the capacity we have now for blowing each other to smithereens with all the nuclear weapons we have so foolishly developed, we'll be out of here. But the planet will continue. Believe you me, it'll continue. It's the most perfectly positioned in the solar system. It's got everything right, abundant water, all sorts of biota. It'll stay put. We will go away. And good riddance to us, I say.
I won't venture there, but I understand the sentiment. One of the things you talk about in this book, Simon Winchester in Pacific, is talking about the huge damage that human beings can wrought, can wring, is a new era in undersea exploration and exploitation of natural resources. We don't have a whole lot of time left, but I wonder if you could touch on this and also on, you know, what can save us from destroying the ecosystem that we are now beginning to discover.
Well, it's a wonderful question. Yes, we've discovered, thanks to Alvin and that lovely little device that the Woods Hole people have been dipping into the sea, we've discovered hydrothermal vents, we've discovered black smokers, we've discovered white smokers, and we've discovered these vast fields in the ocean, near the ocean trenches, full of beguiling quantities of the sulfide forms of all sorts of minerals, like zinc and copper and iron and so forth, and more precious minerals besides. So what are we doing? Are we leaving them down in the ocean? No, we're not. We're developing gigantic mining machines. A group of them are now being built in Newcastle upon Tyne in England, where, oddly enough, I used to work back in the 1960s as a young reporter. And these huge machines with blades and chopping devices and buckets are being taken to these mineral fields off Tonga, off Papua New Guinea, being lowered into the sea on cables, and are then crunching their way along the seafloor, destroying everything in sight, and pumping it back to the surface, where the minerals will be put into barges and carted off to the smelters in China and in Australia. It's as if we can't leave these things alone. Why don't we sort of say, let's not take every available piece of zinc and copper and chromium that lies down there, and just let the sea be the sea. And we're doing it in all sorts of places. I mean, the Great Barrier Reef is a classic example. Here is the longest, the biggest living creature on the planet. But it turns out not only has it been damaged by the warming of the sea that causing the bleaching of the corals there, but the Australian government is turning a blind eye to all these coal ships which are leaving ports near the Great Barrier Reef and going up to China and scraping the reef, damaging it, covering it with coal dust, because the Australians love doing business. The almighty dollar triumphs and the poor sea in between suffers. I say, let's halt or slow down our greed and our commerce and let the sea recover. It's a wonderful, beautiful thing which is hugely important to the planet.
Yes, and in fact, you end the book. We didn't talk much about China. I think our listeners will have to just read the book because I'm sure that's something in the forefront of many of our minds here, especially with recent events offshore in China, with China building up these new islands and coming collision of the world superpowers, as you call it. You call for respect, reverence, accommodation, admiration. Tell us, what do you feel we need to do in order to perhaps avert some of the worst of our predations on the Pacific?
Well, basically, not interfere. Let them in. And there are some good signs. After all, in the last 30 years, most of the powers that have colonized the Pacific and its neighbors have moved away. I mean, the United States is no longer involved, thank heavens, in Southeast Asia. The British, we left Hong Kong. We've only got one tiny little colony, Pitcairn Island, remaining. The Germans and the Japanese have retreated back to their homelands. The French, well, the French are still there in the South Pacific, but in a generally sort of benign way. So the Pacific is getting able to stand on her own two feet. And Polynesia in particular, that great triangle which runs from Hawaii in the north to Easter Island in the east and to New Zealand, or Aotearoa as it's known, on the west, that is becoming a place now that is teaching us wonderful things about its old traditions, particularly about navigation. There's this amazing Hawaiian canoe now going round the world using no instruments at all, no compass, no sextant, and certainly no GPS. She's in the Indian Ocean now. She's soon going to be in the Atlantic. She'll be going up the Potomac to show herself and to greet the Hawaiian president, President Obama, before going down past Cape Horn and back into the Pacific. As we read about this thing, we're reminded these Polynesian people were wonderful and they had great knowledge, and that we shouldn't disdain and disrespect them as we have for the last 200 years. We should respect them and the ocean they live in.
Well, that's a terrific place to stop. We're back full circle where we began, but certainly on a more hopeful note. Simon Winchester, thank you so much for writing this terrific book, Pacific, and talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
It's been wonderful. Thank you so much for having me.
Next up, we talk with Pamela Rottner Sakamoto about her book, Midnight in Broad Daylight. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Stay tuned.
Qu'on voit danser le long des golfes clairs à des reflets d'argent, la mer des reflets changeants sous la pluie, la mer au ciel d'été confond ses blancs moutons avec les anges si purs, la mer bergère d'azur infinie. Voyez près des étangs ces grands roseaux mouillés.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When historian Pamela Rottner Sakamoto was working on her dissertation in Japan, she stumbled on a story so remarkable she vowed to write about it when her dissertation was finished. The story is about Harry Fukuhara, a Japanese-American decorated hero of World War II, and his family, who were divided by that war on both sides of the Pacific. Moreover, the family was originally from Hiroshima, and Harry's older brother, Victor, ended up dying from radiation sickness after the U.S. dropped the atom bomb on his city. Sakamoto's book, Midnight in Broad Daylight, tells how the Fukuhara family came to America, what they found there, why some of them returned to their ancestral home in Japan, and how the war first divided and then united them. It also talks about how they confronted discrimination in America and how they overcame it to survive and thrive. It's a terrific tale that reads like a novel. Pamela Rottner Sakamoto is an American historian. She's fluent in Japanese and lived in Kyoto and Tokyo for 17 years. She now lives and teaches in Hawaii. I spoke to her in January via Skype and started out by asking her how the Fukuhara family first came to America.
Well, Harry's father was a young boy impoverished in Hiroshima Prefecture, and many immigrants to the United States from Japan came from Hiroshima Prefecture. And he emigrated in the early 1900s to work on the railroads, which is part of the great American story of expanding the frontier. And he was relatively successful, enough actually to rise to the professional class, and he called for a bride, and there was an arranged marriage, and his wife, Kinu, also came from Hiroshima Prefecture. She was a picture bride, and she came around 1911, and then they had five children in the Seattle area, and Katsuji, the father, and the mother, Kinu, are Issei, or first-generation Japanese-Americans, and their five children, American-born, American citizens, were Nisei, or second-generation Japanese-Americans. And their story is extremely typical of the wave of Japanese emigration to the West Coast and Hawaii from the late 1800s to the early 1900s, when it was completely stopped.
With great effort and persistence, Harry's father, Katsuchi, overcame prejudice to become a kind of bridge between the Anglo and Japanese communities. And like so many immigrants, he concentrated his hopes on his children's future.
He bore the American dream for his children, that they would graduate from colleges. He could not because they had been born and were being raised in the U.S., and that they would be white-collar workers and that they would someday own their own homes. He, as a Japanese immigrant, could not, by law in the state of Washington, purchase land so or ever become a citizen of the United States. But he wanted that for his children. His children, of course, were born citizens, but he wanted them to be able to buy land someday and achieve every one of their dreams.
Yeah, so talk a little bit more about the racism and the discrimination that they encountered. I mean, some of the Japanese had their own farms, had been able to buy land, but then things changed.
Right. They slowly lost that through legislation at the state level. It was happening in California as well as Washington. And they gradually were forced to give up their land, and they were becoming tenant farmers. So they essentially came over to work on the railroads, worked very hard, were able to become farmers and owners, and then found themselves slipping back. And even their children, who were raised to value education and to excel in school and to really be fully engaged Americans, even if they were able to enter, for example, the University of California, Berkeley, or Stanford, you know, really wonderful schools, the schools didn't have any hopes for them either that the children would be able to enter fine professions because firms would not hire them. So at every level, Japanese and Japanese Americans faced obstacles, and Harry's family came up against these as well. As Japanese farmers lost their land, Harry's father's business diminished, and he sort of expanded into dairies and helping truck farmers take their produce to Pike's Market in Seattle. But he was always on the edge. He was always sort of calculating in his head and keeping his worries from his family.
Now, there are five children, as you say, all born in America. The two older siblings, Mary and Victor, were sent back to Japan when they were still children. Why were they sent back?
This, too, is very much part of the Japanese experience in the United States. parents saw the discrimination and they worried that their American children would not be able to achieve those very dreams that they held for them. And they thought that if their children went back to Japan, stayed with relatives, attended Japanese school, got some level of competency in the difficult Japanese language, and then returned to the U.S. later, they would have a better chance. For Victor as a boy, and then in the future as a man, he would be able to, for example, work in a Japanese trading company or even work at a Japanese government office as an American employee. And they felt that that was a potential route for success, much as today we think that the more languages we speak, the more marketable we are. And for Mary, they hoped that she would be a respectable or a match for a well-educated young Japanese-American man, because she would be both refined in Japanese ways and also fully American. What happened, though, was when the kids went abroad, and this happened with many families, is that it was very hard to come back and reintegrate into American society. Their English suffered. They were different from the rest of their families when they returned, and there was this disconnect.
So the two oldest kids were sent to Japan, and then the rest of the family followed. They followed after Father Katsuji died. And so Mother Kinu brought her three younger children, Harry, Pierce, and Frank, to Japan with her. Why did she go back at that point?
So in 1933, the height of the Great Depression, Harry's father contracted pleurisy. He died, and his widow knew that she could not make a living in the United States, and nor could her children fully. And she had very little left in her savings account, maybe just enough for a few months more of rent. But if she went back to Japan and she would receive some life insurance money, the dollar, because of the exchange rate, would go much further. She had a large and loving and prosperous family, and they would help her out. And she was just much more comfortable there. So she felt that she had no choice because financially she could not stay. But it was devastating for the kids, who regarded themselves as American, and for particularly 13-year-old Harry, a young adolescent fully at home in the United States, who regarded Japan, where he had never been, as very foreign. But his sister Mary, too, was not thrilled about being in Japan, and everybody would go back, but some of them would have more of a rocky landing.
What was the situation for the kids? I mean, they faced real discrimination in Japan because of their Americanness. So talk about this kind of culture clash that was affecting them.
Right, they were caught between two worlds, truly. Once they returned to Japan, they were viewed as foreigners and as Americans, and Japan, by this point, was already on a war footing. Tensions were rising, actually. Japan was at combat in China, and there was an anti-American sentiment as well. So they didn't speak very good Japanese at all. Harry was in the second grade in Japanese class in Seattle, his after-school class, because he had no interest in learning and tried actively not to learn. So when he went to Japan as a 13-year-old, he was placed in the second grade. And we can imagine how much he enjoyed that. He quickly quit, and his mom hired him a tutor, and she had to find another school, and she found a school that was charging tuition for Japanese-American students and teaching some of its classes initially in English. And he made this whole pack of Japanese-American friends, because there were other kids in Hiroshima who, like Mary and Victor, had been sent back by their families for their education. But he needed this network of Japanese-American friends because he felt very much adrift, as did the other kids. But Victor and Mary had the language, and the younger boys, Pierce and Frank, they were able to pick up the language and adapt. Harry also became very fluent in Japanese, but psychologically his heart and emotionally his heart was still in the States.
In fact, as Pamela Sakamoto describes in her book Midnight in Broad Daylight, Harry returned to the U.S., but he found his childhood friends had moved on and anti-Japanese sentiment was on the rise. The only work he could find was as a day laborer working in the fields. His sister, who had returned with him, got married and moved away. Then war broke out between Japan and the U.S. in December of 1941. So then we come up to 1941 and the attack on Pearl Harbor. What was the immediate impact of that attack on the Japanese community in the U.S.?
Immediately, there were roundups by the FBI of leaders in the Japanese community, for example, Japanese language school principals or Buddhist church leaders. So the level of fear within 24 hours was just palpable. And Harry was living and working for a Caucasian family in the Los Angeles area in Glendale. They were very loving towards him, but he also had a lot of jobs, like gardening jobs on the side, and he was on the spot as Pearl Harbor occurred. He was fired by his employer, and she was a friendly woman, and he didn't really understand what was going on. He didn't even know where Pearl Harbor was, but he tasted the anger and the fear immediately, and the situation would only get worse.
And then he and Mary were evacuated like all of the other Japanese Americans in the western part of the United States. They were evacuated to these concentration camps. What were they like? First, they were basically evacuated to a stable or a barn.
Right. It was a very hastily organized affair. In February of 1942, President Franklin Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066, and this basically allowed, quote, evacuation to occur. And the military on the West Coast, the command immediately started making plans. But within 3 months, they were moving people. And so Harry and Mary were sent to Tulare, which was a county fairgrounds, and they were housed in basically a horse stall. You could still see the hay. You could still smell the previous occupants. There was very little that had been added. There was a dangling bare light bulb overhead. And that was just a temporary solution while these concentration camps, as you put it, and that's what they are called today, although they were called relocation centers at the time or internment camps. But even President Roosevelt used the term concentration camp. In August of 1942, after spending several months at Tulare, they were transferred to Gila River in Arizona, one of 10 concentration camps in these remote areas of the United States. That, too, was an unfinished affair. They could see between the slats of their barrack the sand of the desert underneath. Sand blew everywhere with frequent sandstorms. It was bleak. It was guarded. They had no idea how long they would be there, and that uncertainty was excruciating. It was a very dark period, particularly for Harry, who was 22. He did not have that college education now that his dad had wanted for him, and he didn't know what would follow. Mary had a little girl, Jeannie, and so she was able to focus her energies on the sweetness of a young child, but they both struggled.
So he found a way out. He joined the Army. He became an Army linguist. Talk about the unit, you know, that was set up and how in some ways the war provided him with an opportunity.
Yes, he would be the first to say that. At the time, he didn't know. He didn't know much more than this wasn't a way out of the camp. And he was becoming so bitter, so unfamiliar to himself, that the opportunity to leave was a relief. And so the Military Intelligence Service itself was very new. It was a hasty response to the realization that in the Pacific, the Japanese were a fierce enemy. They were on the upswing. The Allies were in deep trouble, and no one could decipher their language. And the Japanese knew this and were leaving maps and reports around battle fronts, but no one could figure it out. And if somebody could figure out the language, then there would be some tactical and strategic advantages. So Harry takes a test for this service, and he passes with flying colors from his time in Japan. And he, because his eyesight is so poor, thinks that he'll end up staying stateside and translating documents. But he's actually, like his dad, such an extrovert, so good with people, friendly, and so bilingual that he is sent to the Pacific to interrogate prisoners.
This is where you start talking about the nuances of his position. I mean, after all, here he is interrogating prisoners. He cannot think of them in the same way as his white colleagues in his unit do.
Now, they are very quick to fall in line behind the slogans, kill or be killed, there will be no more Pearl Harbors, never again. And Japanese prisoners, well, there are very few. Japanese soldiers do not surrender, officers in particular, and Americans do not take them alive. It works both ways. But Harry has a level of cultural understanding and empathy. I mean, he has no doubt that he's an American and that he has a job to do. When he interrogates Japanese prisoners of war near the front, he has to find out very quickly what kind of information they have and whether it can be put to good use. But he knows that they are not this subhuman enemy as depicted by the press and as swallowed by many. He knows that they're young men just like him.
Now, you don't really get into this. I mean, did he ever use torture to interrogate them?
What's really interesting, Harry and I talked a lot about this because of what was happening at the time that I was interviewing him with the whole discussion of torture in the United States and the Mideast. And Harry was emphatic about this, that torture did not work, that it was much better to be respectful and to recognize the person on the other side is clearly being in American hands, but that person should be treated, be given water, be given food, be given medical care, and that the kindness for that person's basic human dignity would elicit far more than torture.
Then he has to face the prospect of the U.S. Army invading Japan. He goes to the Philippines. He's there. The talk of invasion is swirling around. How does he feel about that?
Right, by the summer of 1945, he is in Manila, and he is looking at a November 45 invasion of Japan, and he just knows that it's going to be horrible. He does not believe that the Japanese will surrender women, children, the elderly. All of these civilians and soldiers will fight to the death, and he's worried about his family, his mom and his brothers, and he asks to be released, and he's not, and he knows that he must go, and it chills him. He will go and perform his job. He doesn't know whether he will survive, nor is he sure whether his family will. It will be a terrible battle.
And what was his reaction after the bombing of Hiroshima? He lost some family members there who, in fact, his brother Victor eventually dies of radiation sickness. What was his idea about that? Did he view it as a war crime?
That's really interesting. He was willing to discuss so much with me, but the atomic bomb was such a sensitive issue both for Harry and his brother Frank. Frank was in the Japanese army. They were slated to be in the same place if an invasion had taken place by the Allies of Japan. Harry took the sort of standard line that the atomic bomb shortened the war significantly, and if an American invasion had taken place, and if it had taken a long time, and it probably would, in his mind, then the casualties on both sides would have been catastrophic, higher than they were with the bomb. But it wasn't something he was comfortable with. And Frank was not happy about the bomb, had much more conflicting feelings than he was willing to express. Harry never wanted to go to Hiroshima. That was the only place he resisted.
So finally, I'd like to ask you about how you wrote this book, because you create such vivid details about the lives of the characters. I mean, it reads like a novel. And I had to ask myself over and over again, how did you know this stuff?
It is very much putting together a puzzle over time. This book took a very long time. I met Harry in 1994, started the book with his full cooperation and that of his siblings in 1998, and it's just being published now. There was a lot of my listening to Harry and Frank and their surviving siblings at length, and then repeatedly interviewing and making sure that the story stayed the same, and then interviewing others who would have been in the same places at the same time and corroborating the accounts and then checking the documents.
I also remarked to Pamela Sakamoto that in her book, Midnight in Broad Daylight, there are dialogues reproduced that read like fiction, but they're fact. I wondered how she managed to so faithfully recreate them.
Harry, he was in his 70s and well into his 80s. He died in April at 95, but he had almost a photographic memory for names and dates, because I would record his story and take notes, and then I would go back and find documents, and it always matched up. So I was lucky with him. And then, for example, there was the neighbor of his mom in Hiroshima, and she was with his mother on the day of the atomic bomb. And she, too, had a fabulous memory. And a lot of this was research at the local level. She recreated the times for me of their neighborhood and of the larger extended family. And I was able to go to places as small as a local merchant association and look at their records. I was able to look at a lot of unpublished sources, photographs, old recordings, old newspapers, and that is how I did it.
Well, you did a terrific job, and it is a terrific book, Midnight in Broad Daylight, A Japanese-American Family, Caught Between Two Worlds. Pamela Rottner Sakamoto, thank you so much for sharing this story with us here on Writer's Voice.
Francesca, thank you so much for today.
You can read an excerpt from Pamela Rottner Sakamoto's book, Midnight in Broad Daylight, by going to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.